this week on the Back Table Podcast.
We're using the PDS ends and running to the other side and tying and running to the other side and tying. So they're already placed. Okay, so in my mattress, I tie the one end very short. And so it gives me, I use 8-inch sutures. And so I have length on one side. And so I do once, I then run left to right, and I run right to left, and I tie those.
Oh, like a little purse string like this around?
Not a purse string, it's a running.
Running, okay.
It's a running, but it's only partial thickness. And I find that I keep folding in that the defect more and more. And then my final layer is an imbrication of an OV with OV-Lock.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Back Table OBGYN podcast, your source for all things obstetrics and gynecology. You can find all previous episodes of our podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and on backtable.com. Welcome back to another episode of Back Table OBGYN. This is your host, Mark Hoffman, and I've got Amy Park with me again. Amy, how are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. We have a special guest, and all of our guests are special, but today is pretty special because we have a good friend of mine, one of my original mentors, longest serving mentor in my life. So he's as much responsible as he is to blame for much of my career. But we've got Dr. Charles Miller. Chuck, welcome to the show.
Mark, Amy, so glad to be here, guys.
No, thank you for coming. For those who don't know, and there probably aren't very many, but for those who don't know, Chuck is a reproductive endocrinologist and minimally invasive gynecologic surgeon in Chicago, outside of Chicago, at Advocate Lutheran General Hospital. He's the director of the Fellowship in Minimally Invasive Gynecologic Surgery at Advocate Lutheran General and past president of AGL and immediate past president of the foundation of AGL. Chuck, welcome to the show.
Hey, glad to be here.
We're going to talk about ismacele, something that I can say that prior to getting into this line of work, I don't think I'd heard that word said once in residency.
Hey, Mark, I don't even think we did an ismacele repair while you worked with me.
I don't know that I knew or had heard the term ismacele until well out of training. So that's what we'll talk about today. But before we get into the weeds on ismacele, Chuck, why don't you tell us about yourself and how you got to be where you are. And knowing you, Chuck, I'm going to say, remember, it's just an hour show.
You know, it's funny because I ended up doing my original training in OBGYN at Parkland. And as you know, Parkland is all about obstetrics. But from the day I walked in, I wanted to do infertility. And I remember one of my mentors, Paul McDonald, used to say, you can train a monkey to do infertility. And I would venture to say with what we do now, it's anything but. It's a very exciting area with genetics and IVF and surgery. And there's such a smorgasbord. But I actually trained during my fellowship to do microsurgery. So in the schema of Homo sapiens, microsurgery makes me a Cro-Magnon during my training. And then ultimately, I went to a multi-specialty group doing reproductive medicine, then went on to a single specialty group doing reproductive medicine in the early 90s, and then went to myself, and then with a joint venture with the hospital, and back with myself, I added minimally invasive gynecologic surgeons, and most currently, I'm part of a large network of reproductive endocrinologists, still with my minimally invasive gynae surgeons, but I'm now with Colorado Center of Reproductive Medicine. And it's really exciting. It's a new venture. So here I am at 70 years old, and I'm still learning, and I'm still doing it. I'm still having fun. And I still think medicine is a noble profession. Are we done with the hour yet?
Exactly. It was good having you on the show, Chuck. Thanks for coming.
Thanks very much.
No, you've always been somebody who has stood out from the crowd in what you've done, not just in, you're a very outspoken person. You care a lot about what you do. But you've always been an educator. You've always been a mentor and someone who lives, I think, a very big life. And I mean that as a compliment. I was a resident in Chicago with Chuck. He was our only laparoscopic experience, basically, in residency. When I got there, they said, we saw in your letter you like laparoscopic surgery. Well, we don't. So good luck. And so we got to go up and train with you and didn't get to do as much because my twins were born when I was supposed to be
Absolutely.
Rotating with
That's
you.
That's the most important thing I'll ever remember from anyone in any resident I ever trained. Mark Hoffman had his twins.
It was wild. I was up there like my first day or second day in the OR and the cell service didn't work in the ORs. And I told Kristen, hey, just, something comes up, just call a hospital and ask for Chuck's OR. And then they're doing time out and I hear my name. And I was like, oh, I guess they have my name. You go, no, your wife's calling you to the OR. She's in labor. Just 2 months early. So Chuck looks at me and goes, see you, dude, and kicks me out of the OR. And, you know, like there was not that I expected anything different from anybody. We're residents, right? And it's such a hierarchical thing. And just it was always people first. And he's been that way since the minute I met him. And I'm grateful to call you a friend. And this is a joy.
Good friend.
But this is all over. We get to catch up and do other stuff. So I just want to let you know how much I appreciate you, your mentorship, your friendship, and how much I enjoy being around you. So that's personal note for anyone listening who cares.
I have to tell you, it's back at you because it's so marvelous when you think of being able to mentor and then follow the paths of some of the people who have just spread their wings and just flown. And it's truly exciting. I mean, you'd say, we use the words legacy, you make me immortal, whatever. I mean, it's just so fun to watch all the things that you do in your life and others that I've had a chance to mentor. And it's truly has given me such tremendous satisfaction, gotta tell you. So back at you, Mark.
Well, no, I appreciate that. No, thank you. Well, now to the fun stuff. ISMSEAL. Talk to us about ISMSEAL, like how this became a thing in your practice, like what it is, how it happens, how we diagnose it, and like a little background just on what ISMSEAL is.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting entity because the first time it was talked about was 1995. I mean, that's an amazing thing when you think that this is such a very common problem. I mean, if you look on ultrasound, and you look at where the C-section was performed, roughly 30% of women will have a niche, a defect in their C-section after their first, upwards to 60% and nearly 100% after their third. And yet, it was never really identified. Interestingly enough, Mark and Amy, years ago, I did a hysterectomy on a lady and for abnormal bleeding. And I couldn't figure out where the bleeding was coming from. So we finally did the hist and pathology came back and said there's a defect in the lower uterine segment. And I still wasn't smart enough to correlate that it was from her C-section scar. Well, I know that Cam Najat in the early 2000s did a laparoscopic repair of ISMSEAL, started doing more reading, started doing more, having more concern with patients in my own practice, having fluid in their endometrial lining and couldn't do transfer, found out that others were having the same problem and looked back and said, oh my gosh, this is the C-section scar. This is the niche. This is the ISMSEAL. And lo and behold, with treatment, we have had we've had excellent success. I mean, of the patients that I have done and looked back on since I started doing the procedure in 2014, we have a 70% delivery rate. And that obviously is quite high. So it is a procedure that you can correct and have great success with the correction.
So talk to us about how we diagnose it and then also about signs and symptoms, because,
okay,
you know, I think I read ultrasounds as part of my practice. We see it all the time. how do we differentiate isthmocele as a symptom, as a cause of symptom, and how do we differentiate isthmocele as a cause of infertility?
I think that's a good one, because that always comes back at me, especially in fertility part. From a standpoint of diagnosis, one can either use a transvaginal ultrasound. I have a tendency to look at the saline-infused sonogram, understand that an SIS will enlarge the defect, the isthmocele. You can look at hysterosalpingogram. You can look at MRI. And finally, you diagnose it hysteroscopically. Ultimately, the symptoms that I probably care about the most is the fluid, the inflammation at that C-section defect at the isthmocele backs up into the endometrial cavity and disrupts implantation. But perhaps the most common symptom that isthmocele causes is abnormal bleeding. If that patient, Mark, says to you, I'm bleeding, and then after my period, I still continue to bleed, and has a history of C-section, think about isthmocele. Because if you think about it, that blood is trapped in the niche. And then after a woman is done with her menses, that trapped blood comes out as a discharge. Not only that, some women will present with heavy menstrual flow. And then there's times when someone will present with pain related to the niche. I'm not sure, some of that may also be due to, oftentimes we see a lot of scarring at the C-section site with these patients. So bleeding, fluid for infertility, and also pain, probably most important symptoms.
So you're seeing C-section scars on ultrasound, but then you're seeing fluid in the cavity as well. And is that really kind of your red flag that this is what's going on?
So my red flag is going to be a couple things. Generally, number one is fluid. Most of the patients that I do perform surgery on have fluid in their cavities. The second most common reason that I do this is looking at this and their myometrium above the defect is so thin that one is concerned about the possibility of how they'll fare with pregnancy. Now, these are patients that have only a couple millimeters of myometrium. Now, obviously, Mark, there's not great data to say that, but I think it's only you just have to think through this, that area becomes so very thin as the uterus grows. So that's another reason where I will offer isthmocele repair, although most of the patients are presenting with infertility, usually due to fluid.
Wait, so I just want to ask, as somebody who doesn't really see this at all, the main symptoms and signs, you were read the signs. So the symptoms are bleeding and pain, right?
And yeah, less so pain.
Oh, more bleeding.
Really, bleeding is the most very common symptom. And then the concern about fertility. I would say pain is probably the third issue. And now that not all that pain is related to the inflammation of the isthmocele, it can be due to scar tissue at the C-section site. So I would tell you the two main would be bleeding, and then fertility.
So the infertility, is that from essentially cytokine release at the site of the isthmocele, or what's the mechanism of that?
It could be inflammatories like cytokines. We see endometriosis at the site. We see adenomyosis at the site. Sure, so it's inflammation. Endometriosis, that is generally, and obviously, endometriosis also causes local inflammation with cytokine release, etc., and therefore it can disrupt implantation. So that's yet another factor. So even in a situation where you may not see fluid necessarily in the endometrium, you still have an inflammatory area that's impacting implantation.
So can I just ask, and I don't know if there's data on this, but, you know, I guess I'm dating myself, but, you know, that whole thing when I was a resident, single layer versus double layer uterine closure. I mean, now it's so different. Everybody's just ripping through and not doing a bladder flap. Do any of these techniques make a difference?
That's a very good question, Abe. We believe that two-layer closure will minimize the risk, not take it away, obviously, but would lessen the risk. But there's no study that really has been able to compare. Okay, so it would be a great study for us to all do across the United States and really invest the time to do one layer and two layer repairs and then look and see this. Other things that have been mentioned are retroverted uteruses. If you think about it, the corpus, the heavier corpus of the gravid uterus is splitting that C-section site in the retroverted uterus. Prolonged labor, especially when you've been a prolonged second stage labor, you've really thinned out that area, can be a factor. There's been, Togis Talandi did a nice study where he looked at factors, came up with women with diabetes are at greater risk of C-section defects, C-section niches. Makes sense. They may have healing issues. So those also interplay as well. So particularly when I ask, obviously with my patients, I always ask, tell me about your C-section. You know, most people in infertility said, okay, you have a C-section, check, next question. But no, I want to know, was there a rest? Were they dilated to 10? You know, were they pushing for 3 hours? These are all setups for isthmus seals.
How about use of suture? Like, you know, I trained with Vicryl. Are people using PDS now? I have no idea. Like, is that less inflammatory? I have no idea.
Yeah, I don't know.
You know, the barbed suture or something, like how people do myomectomy?
Hey, the last baby I delivered was my daughter in 1984 with the obstetrician yelling at me. I looked at him. I said, Arnie, I trained at Parkland. I've delivered 10,000 kids. Back off. So I wouldn't know.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I was just wondering because it's like, once the problem's here, it would be great if we could just prevent it, right? So it sounds like
best.
We don't know. Yeah, we don't know the... So we're talking about secondary infertility. Obviously, somebody's had a C-section before.
Right.
And then...
But it's a major factor. I mean, it's probably... Here you have these embryos and you can't do a transfer because of fluid. Now, you do have... There are things you have to rule out, obviously, in this. We have to make sure there's not intrauterine adhesions. Obviously, you can get fluid with adhesions. You can get hydrosalpinges. So there are things that you have to worry about in endometritis. Make sure there's not polyps. I mean, there's other things that can be related to fluid. But once you've taken down that checklist, boy, an isthmus seal is concerning. And you're right, cytokine release.
So I've heard so many names for it, uterine niche,
yeah,
isthmus seal. I mean, it's been hot.
Yeah.
In all the meetings, like watching the videos, I was the program chair for SGS last year and the year before I was co-chair. So I watched a lot of videos and there's so many ways to treat it. There's like ultrasound guided suction DNC. There's robotic or laparoscopic resection. There's wedge resection. There's take down the bladder types. Do you use bulldog clamps? Do you know, there's like a million different ways that I've seen. I've seen huge chunks of the uterus taken out. I've seen, you know, Foley placements. I've seen, you know, post-op estrogen. Like, I'm just curious, like, what are your thoughts?
I do it right. My technique is the right one. Well, okay. So let's start off saying, there's three general approaches. It is transvaginal and just to shave down the defect. That's hysteroscopic. There's transvaginal where you're actually going in and removing the defect. That's done a lot in Asia, much more much more performed in Asia than in the United States and Europe. We primarily, if our defect, there's a lot of myometrium above the defect, we will shave. Okay, we'll do it hysteroscopically. If, on the other hand, that defect, again, the myometrium is very thin, the defect is very large, we will do a robotic-assisted resection. Now, you know, it's really funny how I was presenting this at ESGE, European Society meeting this year, and I was accosted by a doctor whose fellow had presented on sustainability, and I was doing a robotic isthmoseal repair. And Frank said to me that I don't understand sustainability because I can do this laparoscopically. You're Chuck Miller. You've been doing laparoscopic surgery for 40 years. And I looked at him and I said, Frank, I do this particular surgery better via the robot. And that is because I am one of these people who does a very wide excision on the isthmoseal. I take that entire isthmoseal out. I go back on either side. I say, I don't want to see a wedge. I want to see a round defect that I repair. So you can imagine how much I'm resecting with this. And then I will put in a layer of suture that goes through and through. And those are interrupted mattresses. And I generally put in four, one at each corner, and then two between. I then take the long end of each of the end mattress sutures and run it to the other side. So then I have another set of sutures. Those are mid-level sutures. And then I come and imbricate it with, and these are OPDS. And then I come and imbricate it with a OVLOX suture. So it is a real aggressive repair. But one of the things that I've noted is if you look at literature, no one can get by about a 50% delivery rate, at best, a 50% pregnancy rate, and even lower delivery rate. And we have been able to march that up much higher with this aggressive approach and found, Amy, that we've really not had failures with this since I changed it. So it was really Arthi, Mark, who said, change the suture because we're using 3.0 and had some failure. And it's when we went to the O and we went to through and through suture that the technique really has become just awesome for us and our patients.
OPDS, you said series of interrupted mattress sutures for the...
Through and through the first layer.
For the endometrial, what do you do for the endometrial cavity?
Yeah, we go all the way through the endometrium. So we go from we do take down the bladder. We go all the way through and through the entire myometrium and the endometrium. We found when we left endometrium, we had more of a defect at the end. So different than what we do with myomectomy.
As measured by ultrasound?
As measured by ultrasound, saline, yes. Absolutely. All these patients, before I release them, I get salines on all of them. And I found that when we do myomectomies, Mark, we always teach about stay above the endometrium, stay above the endometrium. This is just the opposite. Go through the endometrium, but we put in multiple layer closure and they're thick sutures. So again, myomas, I always repair with 3.0. These are oats.
Interesting. See, most people repair myomectomies with 2.0 or O, VLOC these days.
Yeah, a lot of do, but we've never since my fellowship. And that's a lot of myomectomies, dude. We pay with 3.0.
No, I saw things that, working with you. I still don't think I've ever seen, but no, and we as before VLOC, we were selling everything
as
telling my fellow MIG surgeons or my residents having to do running locked Vicryl to close these layers and then tying them, and they were just like,
so it's like first layer mattress sutures, then you're using zero PDS V-lock or just a running?
No, running. We're using the PDS ends and running to the other side and tying and running to the other side and tying. So they're already placed. Okay, so in my mattress, I tie the one end very short. And so it gives me, I use 8-inch sutures. And so I have length on one side. And so I do then run left to right, and I run right to left, and I tie those.
Oh, like a little purse string like this around?
Not a purse string. It's a running.
Running. Okay.
It's a running, but it's only partial thickness. And I find that I keep folding in that the defect more and more. And then my final layer is an imbrication of an OV with OV-Lock.
Okay.
We find that we really have, generally at least we'll have about 6 to 7 millimeters of myometrium now that is functional, and we do not see the fluid.
Yeah.
I just do not see fluid.
That's interesting because I have seen these aggressive resections on videos, and I'm like, oh my gosh, that uterus, there's nothing left. It's a big whack. And then a couple of the videos I watched, they show the follow-up imaging with either sonohist or pelvic ultrasound, and it looks fine. I mean, the uterus is such a forgiving organ.
Yes. Far different than the ovary, isn't it? Far different than the ovary. That's it, or the tube.
Like when you're talking about a 6-centimeter uterus,
yeah,
you know, that's non-gravid, no fibroids or whatever, and you're resecting that far back. I mean, I guess you're just taking out all the abnormal tissue.
Yes. And you're putting it in, at the same time, you're lining the tissue up very nicely. It's not only that, it's just that you're bringing that healthy tissue together.
I guess big picture, with the uterus is normally, 6 to 7 centimeters long, a gravid uterus, think about how big it gets, obviously. It's massive differences. So little bits here, I guess it can, it stretches, it overcomes that. So
we are actually in the process of finally writing this up. My newest partner, my ex-fellow, Molly McKenna, is writing up our data finally. And we have nearly 200 cases. So it's not a small number at all. I mean, I've been doing niches for a long time. At a time when, Mark, a lot of people in the country weren't doing them. So I was a natural go-to. So I'd see people from all over the country.
So I think we've all seen the C-section scar topics and, pregnancies in that area and the repairs of those things. And what you're doing is a more aggressive version of that, taking out that whole area. The one thing that I had a harder time understanding was the hysteroscopic resection, because I think if we're talking about the defect being the issue, the thinness of the myometrium being the issue, how does shaving more...
Great question.
...or shaving cervix away improve things? That, to me, seemed to take a problem and make it bigger.
Great question. I'll tell you, there's a couple of things that you're doing. First of all, you're shaving that defect down so that the fluid will come out the cervix. So you're basically, what you're doing is you're shaving the caudal aspect, all right? You're smoothing it out. And so you get tissue of the fluid coming off the cervix. By the same token, number two is you're desiccating or excising the inflammatory tissue in the rest of the isthmocele. So basically, you're coming back to normal tissue. So now some people talk about simply shaving it down the caudal portion and desiccating the top. We go ahead and actually excise the cephalid side as well. We're not trying to shave it down, but we're trying to take out that tissue immediately next to the defect, which is the inflammatory tissue. We also do that at the top of the isthmocele. Now, Mark, we're not going to do that with a woman who has a 3-millimeter myometrium that has to have a thick myometrium. So it is a case that is very specific for us to do. It's that there's problems with fluid, or there's problems with inflammation, there's problems with bleeding, and you're just going in to take away the inflammatory tissue and to give an excess for the an exit for the fluid.
And you're using a resectoscope?
Yes, it's all done by resectoscopy.
Yeah.
Now, it's interesting. Amy, I got to come back to one of the things you said. You know how you mentioned, you know, some people put in a curette and curette out the area, and that's the way they treat ectopics, C-section ectopics. The trouble with that treatment is you still left the isthmus seal. So what we now do with ectopics, and we now have not so many, we have probably about 8 at this point that my team has done, and we go in and we'll do an isthmus seal repair on the ectopic. So we'll do that same repair and repair the isthmus seal robotically or laparoscopically right at that time. And we've been able to follow up these patients. Most have subsequently became pregnant successfully. Many of these isthmus seal patients who have been longstanding fertility patients, Mark, get pregnant on their own because the environment of the uterus is better. But in this case, every one of these has had great repair, thick myometrium after their repair, after a C-section ectopic. So I truly believe, I mean, we don't use bulldog clamps for these. We don't give them methotrexate. We take them back as soon as we realize that this is a C-section ectopic and go in, take out the pregnancy and repair the uterus after the isthmus seal has been resected.
The ones I've done, the ones I've seen, the true isthmus seal repairs that I've done are those pregnancies.
Yeah.
C-section scar ectopics. Open it up, evacuate it, cut up the edges, and then do full thickness, you know, do a stitch all the way through and through, bringing the thick muscle to thick muscle. And I've seen, we haven't done a ton. I don't have a reproductive practice. We're an ultrasound. We've got a patient with a C-section scar ectopic. You need to fix it. And so those are the ones we've done. And I've been able to follow them and see them come back. And the few that I've done, they've done great. They come back. They've had term pregnancies. You're always, you know, fingers crossed, a pregnancy makes its way into the fundus or into the uterine cavity. But yeah, I mean, that full thickness closure, I guess, is not going to be that different than when you do it without the pregnancy. But like sometimes there's not a whole lot of uterus left. And you know, when you get down and open these things up, you're sewing cervix to lower uterine segment. So that can be tough.
Yeah, that does happen. I absolutely, more often than we like. But those actually, and that concerned me when I started doing these, because I was down to the cervix. And I found that those repairs do very well. So I think you can feel comfortable, because let's face it, some of those niches, some of those isthmus seals are because people have gone so low and actually have come into the cervix in terms of their repairs. So that is actually one of the reasons why you're there in the first place, but they do well.
So I don't, like Mark mentioned this earlier, but I guess I got to circle back to the hysteroscopic resection. I'm assuming that it's just the niche is this uterine defect, you know, from a prior C-section, and you're just removing the endometrium and ablating it, and then trying to get rid of that area, that abnormal area. And even though it's thinner in that area, it's the assumption is by getting rid of the abnormal endometrium, even though there's a myometrial defect, that it'll improve. I mean, is there data to show that it's better with the more aggressive approach than the hysteroscopic approach?
And are you getting endometrium when you resect those specials and you send them to path?
Yes.
What's pathology showing?
Yeah, you're seeing endometritis. You're seeing some adeno. You're seeing inflammation. You're seeing fibrosis. Okay. So the trouble, Amy, the trouble with what you asked, okay, the problem with what you asked, what is better, an aggressive approach, laparoscopic, robotic versus hysteroscopic, they're really two different situations. I'm not going to do a hysteroscopic resection for a woman who has a thin myometrium, who has a huge isthmoseal defect. Just like I'm not going to do a robotic approach for a woman who has just a little area that is causing some fluid, but the myometrium itself is thick. The other thing that happens is as I look, because again, I do salines on all these people. After you do the hysteroscopic approach, there is some remodeling. Now, no one talks about that. No one talks about that. But when I look back and I know that I've shaved this area, there is some remodeling. The myometrium looks thicker. The defect itself is smaller. Okay? I can't explain that. I just know what I see.
Are you giving it two fresh edges to stick together?
Yeah. Well, it's not written. That could be to a degree, but I don't know why. But I again, with these patients, and truth is, guys, we've seen marvelous pregnancy rates. I mean, when you look at the pregnancy rates in publication of people doing hysteroscopic approaches, a guy by the name of Gambini, who talks about 41 patients and 41 pregnancies. Well, I mean, that may be a little bit, that may be a little bit exciting, but I'm sure the pregnancy rate is good. You will examine other literature. You see excellent pregnancy rates with this technique, but it is in a very special population, one that does not lend itself to a laparoscopic, or you don't need to do a laparoscopic approach, I should say.
I realize that people come to you because you're REI, but like for Mark, they're going to come to you with a C-section ectopic, but like, how about the people who just have the abnormal bleeding? And because there are like sort of different scenarios where you're going to encounter this. And then they're like, how do you end up approaching that? Because it seems like there are kind of different scenarios, the bleeding patient,
right,
the infertility patient, the asymptomatic patient, you know, what, like how would you counsel these patients?
So I think that's great. So in terms of counseling a patient who is really, let's take two examples of that. Patients coming in who are asymptomatic, and you just, for some reason, you're doing a scan, a yearly scan, you're looking at this patient for something else, and maybe a cyst in her ovary, and all of a sudden you see a C-section defect. Well, obviously, unless that patient is actually looking to achieve pregnancy and has a thick myometrium above the C-section scar, I wouldn't do anything. That's an asymptomatic patient, even interested in pregnancy in the future, I wouldn't do anything. I talked to her about the fact that, look, if you're having trouble, this is something that could be a factor. If, on the other hand, you notice that this is very, very thin myometrium, but she is asymptomatic, I would say to her, again, I don't need to do anything now, but if you are attempting pregnancy, we need to have follow-up. Okay, we need to have follow-up. The patient who is bleeding and is symptomatic, you can consider using progesterones on these people. There have been a couple papers that have suggested use of progesterone works very well. Or follow the same type of approach that we do. Obviously, if someone is not interested in pregnancy any longer, that patient is a candidate. If medical therapy does not work, that bring in hysterectomy. That patient is a candidate for a hysterectomy then. Obviously, we don't do that many, but you can. That we don't do that. I don't see that many patients, but certainly, if it is a thicker area, you can do this hysteroscopically and see how they do. Or if they're sitting on the fence, they are candidates for robotic or laparoscopic correction.
What are the major complications associated with these repairs? Like, what are issues you see post-op and, you know, rare, common?
These are, you know, it's like Amy said before, the uterus is quite forgiving. So you really do not see much of the way of postoperative complications. I mean, obviously you're dissecting out laterally. We go to basically the uterine vessels on either side. And so there is the potential risk of getting into some real bleeding. Probably the biggest risk that we deal with is bladder. Many of these patients, multiple C-sections, as you know, Mark, can have difficulty in terms of dissecting out the bladder. There is the risk, obviously, of failure, that you wake up and you do that saline and there is still a niche and she is still having fluid. But that, with our very aggressive approach to repair, we do not see. And then the usual suspects in terms of an endometritis, in terms of infection that can occur. But this is a safe procedure. It is a safe procedure.
What's the future look like for this? Like, I mean, I think we talked about diagnosis, we talk about treatment options. What's on the horizon?
I think standardization, Mark. I think like anything else, the one thing that disappoints me about surgery and continues to disappoint me about surgery, and that is we've never grasped best practices. We've never really been willing for all of us to get into the sandbox and play together and figure out best practices. There are so many studies available. You're going to end up, hopefully I will be published. We will be published. You're going to get my technique of doing this. Like Amy said, she was head of SGS and the program, and she saw a million presentations, a million different ways. Step right up. There's got to be consensus. We got to be able to introduce consensus.
I mean, yeah. I mean, we can joke about it, but we asked you how you do it, and you said the right way, my way. You know, part of what we see at AEGL is a lot of pioneers, a lot of people doing things that we're told couldn't be done. And these are people, and I think ego is a bad word in many circles,
no.
But I think when you have people who have worked very hard and have learned a lot and have become experts, I think you have some justification in talking about a topic with some semblance of authority. But a lot of people have that same authority in a room like that, have very different opinions. Consensus becomes a challenge in an environment like that.
You're absolutely right. But it is something that we could get. I think that if you got a number of people who do this procedure very often and sat them in a room and talked through a protocol, I think it would be worthwhile. And I would be, and I kid about the fact that my way is the best way. Well, I have some numbers that support that, but nevertheless, I would listen to someone say to me, could we modify it this way? Could we do this? Why don't we do this? Compare this to that. I would love to be able to have a standard way of proceeding with these, just like we do hysterectomy.
We don't have a standardization for C-section. How long have we been doing those?
Now, that's true, but we do. Everybody, you may do something from the contralateral side or the ipsilateral side, but we all basically do a similar technique to hysterectomy. And so we really have improved the steps.
C-section, there's a Green Journal article on standardized, like evidence-based C-section, and it was all the things that I talked about, like...
There you go.
Not doing sharp, doing blunt, not doing the bladder flap, don't close the peritoneum, like all these things that I was like, man, I can tell I have not done obstetrics in a long time. And I talked to the residents and they're like, yeah, and I don't want
Nor
to.
Do you want
but
to.
It's like, you know, there's all kind of things. I mean, I think... I saw a really good, it was like Chinese article in the Green Journal about treatment of, I can't remember, I think it was C-section scar. And they had like criteria, you know, the size, the beta, laparoscopic, vaginal, whatever. And I thought it was quite good.
The only thing, I remember the article, if it's the same article you're referring to, they did some of these C-section. This was a C-section ectopic study.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they did, and they did talk about going up into the isthmoseal with energy and resecting with a loop resectoscope. And my God, that scares the hell out of me. That scares. And the thing that I also found in that article was their follow-up in patients was quite low, So that, yes, there are a lot of techniques, but then what is the follow-up? What are they doing? What's the pregnancy rate? What are we doing with bleeding? As long as that's what I mean by best practices. And I think all of us in surgery, somewhere along the line, have to start playing in the sandbox better. We really do.
Yeah, I just looked up real quick. I love the internet. It was from May 2023, Green Journal, Ban et al. They lifted almost 1,000 women with first trimester C-section ectopic, and then they used a clinical classification based on thickness and gestational sectanometer. An optimal surgical option for each type was recommended. And they looked at the overall success rate of first-line treatment with new classification grouping. It was 97.5%. And it was basically the anterior myometrial thickness of the scar and diameter of gestational sac were confirmed to be independent risk factors for intraop hemorrhage during C-section ectopic pregnancy treatment. So they did try and do, you know, criteria, and then they had nice pictures in this article. But, you know, and they classified it, types A1, 2A, 2B, 3A, 3B, you know. So it was interesting.
It is interesting. I just, here's your chance. In my mind, here's your chance to treat the patient and to excise the isthmoseal. And that's why my way of looking at this is that hysteroscopic is not the way to go, but rather a laparoscopic excision, like you had talked about, Mark, is in my mind, the best way, because you're treating the isthmoseal at the same time. And if I remember correctly, and again, I don't have it in front of me, I'm not as savvy as your generation is in terms of being able to pluck articles in a moment. If I remember, a lot of these patients did not come back for subsequent repair. I would be concerned about a lady who has an ectopic that you evacuate and then say, go get pregnant again. That'd be concerning to me.
Yeah, I don't think they talk specifically about the follow-up rate here.
So this is your chance, Chuck. Next time you go to AGL in the fall, you can...
Yeah, as soon as I get my 1,000th ectopic, Mark.
Well, you won't need to if you get your, you know, get our buddies around the country to come up with a way. Doesn't have to be the right way. Just has to be a way that we can track. And then you have a baseline, and then you can make adjustments and compare that to some baseline that was consensus, which is, you know, not the highest form of research, but then use that as a baseline. But yeah, standardization, because we're all using different techniques.
I'm learning from Philip Koenix about Bayesian analysis in terms of the hypothesis, et cetera. And it may be something that we're going to, that we're doing expert thought, and then because people obviously are getting more and more and more experience, and start off with people and then build on the hypothesis. And there may be something to Bayesian analysis. You may be right.
Well, you know, we had Brett Einerson from University of Utah, who does all this amazing research on placenta accreta spectrum. And he was just, you know, I asked him about C-section topic. He said, thank you for taking care of placenta accreta prior to its formation, because it's part of placenta accreta spectrum, basically, you know, first trimester. So early treatment is obviously better than having placenta accreta. And in the remodeling data that's coming around, you know, talking about his data and his research, it's like the way the uterus remodels around the scar is the main problem.
But if you do these, and if you take these out, you see the defect. I mean, it's there, and to take it out, take the pregnancy out, or even suction it out, and not repair the defect. I mean, to Chuck's point, I think when you've done a few of these and you see the defect that's left behind with the cesarean scar pregnancies and what was there before, you've got to close that space. I mean, this is a giant hole in the low uterine segment. It's like a bomb went off. I mean, even the ones that are very early, when you're not, I mean, the ones we've done for the most part, we catch them early enough, the blood loss is like 10 cc's. They're not a huge bloody procedure, but the defect is significant even in the smallest, earliest ones.
And so thin.
Oh, it's paper thin.
Yeah.
Basically, it's, you know, the outer layer of the uterus. It's not, I mean, we're in front of the serosa, but a very thin myometrial layer, and then just nothing. And so, yeah, I mean, to leave that open and just sort of close it over. So, yeah, I would do full thickness and then imbricate layer over top of that. Again, not because I learned the right way to do it, because, you know, you do some research and read a few articles and try to figure it out, because the data just wasn't there. So anyway, it's fascinating. It's always a pleasure chatting with you, Chuck. This is obviously something that
really fun, guys.
A lot of us need to think more about. But just as I said earlier, on a personal note, to have you here and be a part of this is just such a pleasure for me personally, but also for the show. So thanks for coming on. Tell Mary we said hey. Hope you and the family are good.
I sure will. I just want to tell you guys, I'm proud of what you guys are doing. I'm proud of your generation. You guys are really stepping up. You're leaving us, you know, at a good place. We can fade into the sunset and know that things are good.
I have a feeling you will not. There's no fading. It's going to be a star that explodes at the very end. There's no there's no fading with you.
I still got to get people to put down the damn suction DNC and do hysteroscopic evacuation of pregnancies. Then I can fade into the sunset.
You and Linda, seriously.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, I think to put that damn suction away. All right,
thanks,
guys.
Chuck.
Thanks so much. We'll see you soon.
Thanks so much.
Be well.
Be well.
Bye.
Bye-bye, guys.
Thank you so much for listening. If you haven't already, make sure to follow the podcast, rate it 5 stars, and share with a friend. If you have any questions or comments, direct message us at _backtableobgyn on Instagram, Twitter, or LinkedIn. Backtable OBGYN is hosted by myself, Mark Hoffman,
and Amy Park.
Our audio team is led by Kieran Gannon, with support from
Josh McWhirter,
Aaron Bowles,
Nick Shellcross,
Josh Spencer.
Design and digital marketing led by Brian Schmitz, with support from
Taylor's Version Hess and Yvonne Ovijinsky.
Show notes and social media by Emma Landenwich and Lindsay Beecham.
Administrative support provided by Jamila Kennebrew.
Music written and performed by Scott Baby Daddy Hoffman.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again next time. The views and opinions expressed by the hosts and guests on Backtable OBGYN are their own and do not reflect the views or positions of their employers or any entities they represent.